Hi, and welcome back to another episode of the Outsource Accelerator podcast. This is episode number 319. Today on the episode, I am joined by Anthony DeLuna. He is the president of Flipside. Anthony has a storied career in outsourcing. He's been at it 30 years. He was obviously one of the first in the industry, and we're going to hear all about his evolution alongside the industry's evolution. He has worked with notable names, including Apple and Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and he is now working with some of the world's most advanced AI technologists, including some of the leading autonomous vehicle manufacturers in the world. So it's a super interesting career and journey that Anthony has taken, and of course, it's also a really interesting conversation for this podcast. I'm sure you will enjoy it. If you want any of the show notes, as always, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Outsource Accelerator. We are the world's leading outsourcing marketplace and advisory. We help big and small businesses with their outsourcing needs, and we can help you too. We cover everything from business and staffing strategy, optimal outsourcing structures, implementations, and fully managed services. If you're already outsourcing, about to start, or somewhere in between, then we can ensure that you get the best from outsourcing. That's the best prices, best terms, and of course, the best results from your outsourcing practices. We list over 700 outsourcing suppliers on our website, host this leading outsourcing podcast, and have over 5,000 pages of content. Because we span the entire market, we can ensure that you get the best deal possible. We offer everything from light brokerage, co-managed services, through to fully managed solutions. Get in touch today. Visit us at outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. Mention that you're a podcast listener, and we will give you special attention plus a 10% discount. This is for a limited time only. Go to outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. So, Anthony, I want to start by asking the audience, or maybe yourself, what do Amazon, Apple, and autonomous vehicles have in common?
That's me over the course of 30 years in the offshore outsourcing industry from the Philippines.
That's a bit of a loaded question, isn't it? So, Anthony, you have a vast history in Philippine offshore staffing, not only just staffing. This is nothing near call centers. This is about professional services in the Philippines on the global stage. Maybe you can introduce yourself, then give us an introduction to your stellar career.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. Again, my name is Anthony DeLuna. I'm currently president and a CEO of Flipside Digital Content, doing business these days as Flipside AI. I've worked in this industry since its infancy. Specifically, in 1990, I dropped out of college. I was the editor of the school paper, the college paper, and taking up engineering. And then when I got into the college paper, I thought, hey, I'm not an engineer, I'm a writer. So I pursued a career in writing and dropped off of college. I read about Bill Gates, but never thought that I'd be a Bill Gates after dropping out of school. But yeah, I got a job as a fashion editor, associate editor of a men's fashion magazine, which of course died after 2 issues. And out looking for a job, I found an ad for an editor. When I went in and applied, it was for an American guy starting his business in the Philippines. The company's name was called InnoData. And the business concept was that we do data processing overnight for companies in New York, where his best friend was selling the service to anyone needing data processing, basically keyboarding or typing overnight in the Philippines for 12-hour turnaround to New York. And
these
I joined
so these were non-voice functions. It was the beginning of data outsourcing effectively. What year was this, Anthony?
This was in 1990. And yeah, you're correct. This is data processing, straight up keyboarding, basically converting analog text to digital text. It's data encoding coupled with proofreading for accuracy. And that was the main business of InnoData, except I was hired as an indexer. An indexer at that time was, remember, this was before widespread internet. It basically involved reading articles from different periodicals, from very highly academic to very popular magazines. Basically reading articles and assigning subject headings to those articles. It was like building Yahoo or Google, except we didn't have the foresight for that. We were just doing a service by indexing articles in journals. And they were for CD-ROMs, if you remember CD-ROMs, for academic CD-ROMs. So I was an indexer and abstractor. So after assigning subject headings or index terms, basically have to write abstracts of the articles that you've read for inclusion in those CD-ROMs. Anyway, fast forward, we grew InnoData from about 15 to 6,000 employees, IPO in NASDAQ in 1997. There was one competitor, the earliest competitor in Philippine offshore outsourcing was a company called Zastec Philippines, which then, of course, turned out to be SPI these days, and they're still around. Both InnoData and SPI are still around, but I would consider those two the pioneers of Philippine offshore outsourcing services.
Wow, so you took that company or worked with that company to about 6,000 staff and an IPO on the NASDAQ, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct. Doing the vast majority of the business being data encoding for publishers, scientific publishers, which require shiploads of data to be converted into formats called SGML. This was the mother of XML. XML is in use, of course, on the web now, but before that, there was a format called SGML. So that was the bulk of the work for InnoData. We experimented with call center work, but we didn't succeed there. We did succeed in doing transcription, basically medical transcription for medical publishers or for hospitals or other applications. And then the high value part, the KPO part, being indexing and abstracting. So we had engineers, we had doctors, we had lawyers, depending on the CD-ROMs that were being created for those target audiences.
Crazy, huh? So really knowledge services as far back as 30 years ago.
That's right.
Wow. It didn't just stop there, did it? What was your next foray then?
Yeah, a colleague left InnoData, and I left after IPO. For financial reasons, and a colleague left InnoData as well and joined Barnes & Noble. And this was around just before the turn of the century. And she joined Barnes & Noble as Barnes & Noble just had the largest IPO for a dot-com at the time. This was the dot-com boom. So BarnesandNoble.com just had their IPO, and being the largest American bookseller, they wanted to lead the digital reading revolution. Of course, there were devices that were coming out, such as the Palm Pilot. These are dinosaurs now. But you could somehow read on small screens at the time. So Barnes & Noble wanted to lead the ebook revolution and sell ebooks on BarnesandNoble.com along with print-on-demand books. Basically, these are already digital books that could be printed off the back of a Barnes & Noble branch, maybe beside the espresso machine from Starbucks. But that was the idea. And I joined her at Barnes & Noble, and we put up a ebook and print-on-demand book production facility here in the Philippines, of course. And at that time, Eastwood City was just one building. It was Citibank Center. And we put up the Barnes & Noble subsidiary there called Electronic Publishing Ventures, Inc. We got two floors, which ended up being a little bit too much for us. So we actually subleased some of our space to a small company called People Support. And two floors above us were a company called eTelecare. So this was the beginning of the call center industry.
And those are two of the what started off and now are some of the most prominent BPOs. Yeah, this is the beginning of the entire outsourcing industry, basically, isn't it? And this was just after 2000.
That's correct. This was the voice work, the beginning of what will become the monster voice work that we've been doing here in the Philippines.
And so meanwhile, you were setting up the Philippine subsidiary for Barnes & Nobles, and it was basically to facilitate their plan to digitize books and move them into an ebook format, which was pretty ahead of their time for back in the 2000s. How did that process go?
Yeah, it was a very exciting time. I was traveling around Europe trying to convince publishers to let us digitize their books and sell them on BarnesNoble.com as ebooks, US and Europe. And it was a very hectic time. We had great progress. So if you go into BarnesNoble.com right now and search for some of the ebooks, a lot of them were still the files that we produced from that facility. Remember, this was Amazon was alive, but they didn't have the Kindle yet. So it was really reading on screens on computers in different ebook formats and on Palm Pilots and some other dedicated ebook reader devices. So it was highly advanced technically. We helped define the specification for ebooks as part of Barnes & Noble. There was an
industry. Quite incredible to think, isn't it, that just in the year 2000, it wasn't actually yet native for books to be digital. Like, you would assume that even in 2000, books would have been natively digital, and then they push them across to be printed if they want to go into hard copy, but you're saying it was actually you had to convince publishers to take on the digital format.
Yeah, print has always been and still is the biggest driver of revenue for publishers. So in fact, we were the digital bogeyman that was threatening print revenues for content owners. Well, at least until Amazon came out with the Kindle. And Apple came out with the iPad, and then everything changed after that. So it was all really, portability and readability that was missing when we were starting for Barnes & Noble.
So you were very much at the front of the wave as the world converted to digital format books. Were you able to convince any big or notable titles?
For Barnes & Noble, because they were Barnes & Noble, we had the top six. Well, before the mergers and acquisitions, there were the top six publishers of the world, and we all had them, the Simon & Schuster's, the Penguins, all of the blue chip publishing companies. We had them at Barnes & Noble. But then continuing on, after 9/11 and the dot-com bubble burst, Barnes & Noble shut down our facility here. But I thought of gathering a small team from that company and put up Flipside. That was the beginning of Flipside, actually. Knowing that at that point, ebooks were not really a commercial hit. Stephen King had the hit, but he was Stephen King. I felt that ebooks were going to be a success. So I started Flipside as an ebook production company. The first iteration of Flipside was in 2002, I think. I don't remember, but around that time I put up Flipside from basically as a spin-off of the Barnes & Noble company. So we started converting books for publishers on our own as a service. And because of my contact through Barnes & Noble, we were able to attract some pretty big names from Disney Publishing to, we did Star Wars, all of the Disney franchises. We're still doing to this day the Wizard Boy franchise, which of course is the holy grail of publishing just because of the number of books sold. All of that Wizard Boy franchise, all of their digital assets for ebooks were done by Flipside. And throughout the years, we've helped Apple, for example, launch their iBooks or Apple Books store in China until the trade war started and China shut down the store. So we've also done work for from Wizards to Vampires to Star Wars to Hunger Games, all of the big franchises, we've done the ebooks for those.
And so from a little corner in Manila, you have basically published or produced in some form many of the world's most eminent books, and even including, and you're not actually able to say specifically what it is, but one of them including a Wizard Boy. Can you share any experiences about, you know, the how do you ensure that there's no leaks? How do you ensure that all of this is secure and private? Because, you know, some of these book releases, they're incredible events, aren't they? And it's important to ensure safety, security, and data privacy.
Right. And there are releases, for instance, that would be simultaneous with the print, a play or a movie. So the files were in a very strict embargo on our part. And you're right about the security requirements. So down to basically very closed loop communication from receiving the electronic manuscripts to us coding the HTML to produce the ebooks, and down to sending of the files back to the client. That was a very controlled and very secure process. Obviously, it was very high value material.
Incredible. And you were also then involved with Apple. Any experiences you can share from that?
Yeah, that was a very interesting experience because the contract we got was for Apple Books in China. They were going to launch their bookstore in China, their ebook store in China. So we were actually tasked or contracted to convert books in the Chinese language, basically in Mandarin, and produce ebook files for sale for the launch of Apple Books in China. So we worked with through Apple, worked with Chinese publishers on the conversion process and the ebook production process. But because we can't read Chinese, I had to hire a subcontractor in China for the initial processes, specifically for the content accuracy. But then all of the technical work, producing EPUB files. EPUB is the file format for Apple Books. So doing all of the development that includes, including videos or audio or multimedia elements, animation to the ebooks. That was all done here by Flipside in the Philippines.
And back in the day when America and China were friendly, this was, I assume, a booming market. Like, there's obviously a huge amount of content to be transcribed between the two languages, and I assume that would just be an almost endless market. But what happened then?
Yeah, it was a dream come true for us for Flipside, because China, being the old civilization that they are, just had, you know, unbelievable amounts of content that could be converted to this format. So that was really, really promising. But less than a year into the project, the Great Wall came down and basically shut down the media outlets in China, including Apple Books. It was Apple's most successful launch of a bookstore anywhere in their geographic markets. So, and we were congratulated by Apple for that. But then, you know, nothing you can do when the Great Wall comes down on you.
What was it about you or Flipside or the Philippines, you think, that managed to capture Barnes & Noble and Apple and some of the biggest book titles in the world?
Yeah, I think it's just our, for me personally, having started at Innodata, where accuracy was 99.995, that was the highest level that we offered, content accuracy. I just carried that out throughout my career, and it's just our reputation for quality. And you'd be surprised if I told you that it's also how we got into our current business of AI data services. It's our reputation for quality.
And so that's another chapter, excuse the pun, but you've now evolved, because is it true that most books are now converted? There's less demand because it's becoming native for books to be digital? And then, so there's not the same demand for conversion. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. All of the legacy work, all of the legacy content has been basically converted by the middle of the last decade. So every new book that comes out on print will come out as an ebook simultaneously. It's been ingrained in the production process. So there's not much of a business opportunity trying to chase legacy archives for conversion.
And so what is the next chapter, yeah, in Flipside's story?
Yeah, the next chapter was totally surprising even for us, because we've been in the world of books and electronic publishing, but one day I receive an email from a startup in San Francisco working on their business model was, they were building a tool platform for AI data services. AI, as you know, is artificial intelligence, and they're driven by machine learning models. And machine learning models require huge amounts of data to be fed into those algorithms for the machines to learn, basically. And you can't just feed any data. You have to have properly labeled or annotated data. Their business was about providing the tools for data annotation, but then, of course, they require humans in the loop. And this is the part where humans still need to teach the machines how to be intelligent. So their business model was basically to use cloud workers or gig economy workers to label data, but that wasn't working well because the quality was very poor, and they were trying to think out of the box on how to improve their quality rates so that their customers will accept basically according to quality service levels, the data they were submitting. And I got an email asking if we could help with their AI data processing, specifically the quality control part. So we met with them, and we were very honest in saying, yes, we know high accuracy content, high accuracy data, not just text, but because we're in graphic arts and publishing, we know how to make pages look good. But we don't know anything about the AI data services industry. So they were willing to teach us and train us, and they did. And before we knew it, we were doing data annotation work for the specific purpose of autonomous vehicles. Basically, these are the self-driving cars that are almost out there right now, driving around without people. But before they can do that, we need to label road data. So sometimes when you go into websites, you're asked to click on traffic lights or crosswalks. So that's the lowest level of data annotation for machine learning. But because of the stakes involved, this is, there's news of Uber's driverless car or Tesla's driverless cars hitting pedestrians. So the stakes are very high. You really need high quality data annotation down to the last pixel. So we learned how to do that and started shifting our business from electronic publishing to AI data annotation. And that's what we've been doing for the past 2 years, actually.
Well, so you managed to flip side from books to the latest technology, and now effectively from a corner in Manila in the Philippines, you're now enabling the world's leading AI and autonomous vehicles, and it's really the human power behind the AI power that is driving these vehicles down the street. Can you just explain that for the layman, for the audience out there? I thought AI was computer power. Where is the human element that comes into that?
Yeah, they're computer powered by great algorithms from the best minds of our generation. But before the machines can think for themselves, we have to teach them. The humans have to teach them, and we can do that by labeling the data so that the machine can, after petabytes and petabytes of data, the machines will learn from what we've taught them. And how do we teach them? We basically say, from images, we draw polygons or bounding boxes to tell the machines where the location is or what kind of classification this piece is within an image. And it goes then to other formats like video. But the most sophisticated annotation we're doing is actually for LiDAR, which is like radar, but 360, basically 360 degrees view of the environment of a car or a vehicle. And you basically have to teach the machine where everything is at any given moment. And by feeding that properly and accurately labeled data into the learning models, then it becomes AI. Then it gains intelligence.
And so I've been lucky enough to have a tour around your facility, and it's beyond fascinating to see this stuff in action. And to give people an idea, there's literally, you get sent, what is it, millions or tens or hundreds of millions of single frames, photo frames, effectively, that have been derived from video footage that is then annotated, and you're identifying what a lamppost is, what a different car is, what a pedestrian is, right. and this is annotating those images, and then they are sent back, put into the computers, and then that information is processed. Is that right?
That's right. And when that information is processed by by the computer, then it learns more. It learns more and more, and someday we will achieve level 5 autonomy, wherein it's really full autonomy. There are several levels of autonomy, but the goal is to achieve level 5, at least for self-driving things. Mind you, there are many other applications of AI. For example, we're doing medical AI data annotation, so we get images of different skin conditions, whether distressed skin or diseased skin. And this is for a startup that's trying to apply AI into dermatology. So by applying their computer thinking to what we've labeled on the skin images, then the app can tell a dermatologist, is it eczema or is it something else? Mind you, we don't have to know what the disease is. We just have to accurately mark and label the area of the skin that's in question. So there are really lots of other applications. We're also doing things like eye tracking. So instead of identifying stuff outside on the road for the driverless car, for this one, the camera is inside and pointed at the driver, and you're tracking the eyeballs, the eyebrows, the eyelids, the smile, so all of the facial expressions and sentiments. And there are huge applications not only for ADAS is Advanced Driver Assistance Systems, but also for insurance. If there's an accident, they can the AI can tell them if the driver is actually asleep, given the data that's been labeled for them.
It seems incredible. Like someone twigged on to the fact that you can analyze images and that is really AI, but there's nothing like true intelligence. Actually, it's a form of pattern recognition, and it's someone like yourself that's going through millions of images and putting meaning to those images, creating a pattern from those images that the computer can then relate to other patterns. And that's the foundational technology. And then you see all of these other applications springing up. So it is the autonomous vehicles, it's the skin assessments, and even now inside the car, it's even monitoring the driver to see whether they're awake or whether they're looking at the road or whether they're watching their mobile phone.
Right, exactly. So it's amazing to think that it's almost a full circle for me, having started as an indexer, and I was trying to learn to teach how CD-ROMs would present data by identifying or attaching labels to journal articles, and now we're attaching labels to different formats of data so that the machines will learn. So after some 30 odd years, it's actually the same job, and it's just the job of competent humans aiding computers.
Are you seeing growing intelligence in your own work? Like with the AI, are you noticing that you now don't have to identify or label the big objects and it's more smaller or less defined objects or objects that are being queried? Or is it sort of continually a blank canvas and you are identifying everything as the human?
Yeah, I think I'm not a data scientist, but I think we're far off from the Terminator, as we've seen in the Terminator movies. I think we're very, very far from that, where advances will make a dent on what needs to be labeled on the data. So at this point, we need to label everything as if we were doing it from day one of that industry.
Incredible. And what is the demand for this AI? Have you seen this industry explode?
Skill AI, a company out of San Francisco, with their recent round of funding, I think they've been valued at 3.5 billion, and they're just offering tools for data annotation. So And again, there are just many, too many applications in agriculture, in logistics. We're doing a logistics project as well, basically identifying crates all stacked up in a port somewhere and identifying the labels, the markings. So it's hard to imagine that this won't explode even bigger as an industry.
And a lot of this is asynchronous, so you're sent, millions of files that you then assess and then re-upload. Do you see a future where there's synchronous analysis or even co-control? Do you think that it's possible that an autonomous vehicle might be put in the control of a Philippine driver if, for example, the computer is confused? Do you see any sort of synchronous applications?
For the work that we do, I don't envision that be just because of the way it works. Basically, they have to feed the data we're labeling into their algorithm, into their learning model, and then the data scientist will have to adjust the algorithms, the learning models, before they start data gathering again. This time for the adjusted model, for the smarter for the smarter model. So it becomes smarter with every cycle. So to answer your question, I can't see right now being a synchronous learning situation.
And so you, throughout your entire career, have worked with some of the most, the world's best known companies and brands, and now you are working with some of the most technological brands in Silicon Valley and throughout Europe. Again, where do you see why the Philippines, and what do you think the Philippines has to offer these brands?
Having started again with data processing in the 1990s, and just the culture and the work ethic of this country in terms of providing quality service, and it goes beyond outsourcing in everyday life. That Filipinos just would love to smile for an opportunity to be of great service. So I think that's where that all comes from. And coupled with the fact that we have an education system that's basically been designed by the US and fits nicely into the work culture of the markets that we serve. And I think the voice work, the call center work that we started in the early part of this century contributed greatly to the reputation of the Philippines as a outsourcing or as a service destination.
Anthony, way back 30 years ago when you began your career, you started offshore and you were serving, Western companies offshore 30 years ago when there really wasn't even the technology interface to properly support that. You were dealing in knowledge process outsourcing then. You were working with doctors and lawyers and things like that. So you've always been at the forefront of knowledge process outsourcing, and you're continuing that now with AI. Where do you see the future and limitations? At the moment, it seems that the Philippines is really just doing the sort of the kind of rudimentary aspects of AI. Do you think that the skill sets will develop in the Philippines so that it can be creating the AI alongside Silicon Valley and the best in Europe?
Yeah, definitely. The programming basis for AI is basically the same. It's the data science that I think that's the limitation right now. We have very few data scientists, but if we really want to play the AI game in the future, we need to develop our STEM education and put a focus on producing data scientists to go along with our great programmers.
Have you seen the awareness of the Philippine capacity and services, professional services? Have you seen the awareness of the Philippines grow amongst companies in Silicon Valley and Europe?
Yeah, so I think over the course of our providing services, the last 30 years or so, that's one of the great benefits in that we've seen how they provide customer service, for example, all of the call center metrics. I think that translated to, you know, improving our own business processes in the Philippines. Basically, 30 years ago, customer service really sucked. I mean, sometimes it's still wanting here, but the improvement has been leaps and bounds since we started providing them for other countries. And in terms of technology and knowledge transfer, definitely we've gained a lot from the subject matter experts, from the technical experts that that's been due the course of putting up facilities here in the Philippines.
Anthony, incredible story, and you know, it's been quite a journey for you, I'm sure, and you've seen this industry be born and come to such prominence. What is next for Flipside? What do you think the next chapter might be?
Yeah, in recent months, we've been doing audio annotation. So instead of just transcribing audio in the old days, now you have to label audio data for AI technologies. This is pretty ubiquitous because we have Alexa and Siri. So audio annotation is for that. It's to develop the human interface through speech. So we're working on that, but as far as the immediate future is concerned, we'll continue to grow our, we've developed deep domain expertise in autonomous vehicles, so we think we'll grow in that area.
Incredible. It's, you know, I think everyone takes technology for granted, and they just assume that everything is almost built by a computer now, but there's so much work behind the scenes, isn't there? You know, there's Alexa and Siri, but there's so much work that goes into building the infrastructure and the fact that now things are being picked up by voice, presented by voice, and all of this, as you say, takes the labeling and interpretation. And there's a huge amount of work that is still very much in the realm of the human aspect. So, and it's fantastic to hear that you're a big part of that, Anthony. And what a fantastic journey.
Yeah, a big part of AI is really humans in the loop. So we're proudly representing humans from Quezon City in the Philippines by being those humans in the loop in the AI process.
And there's a big concern that AI is, you know, like the Terminator, is going to wipe out all jobs for everyone. Do you see that as the case, or are you just going to be having more and more humans working behind the curtains to enable the AI to serve the humans? Or do you think there will be a point where all of the interpretation is done and then we don't need the people?
Yeah, I think the applications will just keep advancing, you know, for the initial applications, maybe the machines will be smart enough, but then as humans, I'm sure we'll find other applications for which, again, we need to teach the machines. So whether it's here or space or who knows, but the applications are really boundless.
Anthony, I wish you best on this exciting journey. If anyone wants to get in contact with you or know more about any of the iterations of Flipside, how can they do that?
Yep, I'm most easily reached through LinkedIn. Just look me up on LinkedIn or go to our website, flipside.ai. Basically, that's about it.
That was Anthony DeLuna of Flipside. If you want to get in touch with Anthony or know more about what we spoke about, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. And as always, if you want to ask us anything, then just drop us an email to ask@outsourceaccelerator.com. outsourceaccelerator.com.